Welcome to the MIR podcast. I'm Kathy Posey, a director at MIR.
And I'm Ariana Yupi, Senior Project Officer at MIR. Our mission is simple: open public climate education.
Each episode, we bring on researchers, practitioners, and communicators to unpack the current climate situation across science, impacts, solutions, and policy.
We connect the dots from physics and tipping points to health, urban design, risk communication, and community resilience. At times, we'll explore surface reflectivity and other cooling approaches, including MIR's ground-based democratic installations.
Expect clarity over hype, evidence over buzzwords, and practical takeaways you can use.
Guest ideas or topics, find us on X at MIRSRM or via MIR.org.
All right, let's dive in. Today, we're joined by David Spratt, Research Director at the Breakthrough National Center for Climate Restoration in Melbourne, where he's been leading research since around 2014.
David co-founded the Climate Action Center from 2009 to 2012, previously co-founded Carbon Equity to advance personal carbon allowances, and he comes from a business and communications background spanning research, journalism, book production, and graphic design. His analysis has been featured in outlets and forums like the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, ClimateEmergencyDeclaration.org, and the Transitions Film Festival.
David, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
My pleasure.
We'll jump right in. We'd like to start with some questions regarding the state of the climate. In plain language, what convinces you that warming is accelerating now, not in some distant future? What is the one data point listeners should remember?
Look, I think what's important to understand is that we are at 1.5 degrees now. Scientists use the definition of warming, which is the average over the last 20 years. But in an escalating series of numbers, if you take the average of 20 years, it tells you where warming is 10 years ago. But in fact, 2 years ago was 1.5. Last year was 1.6. The last 2 years is tracking at 1.5 or above. The world's greatest scientist and my hero, Jim Hansen, says for all practical purposes, we're at 1.5. So I think that's clear. The second point, and this is coming out in the literature now, is that the rate of warming has accelerated from about 0.2 to about 0.3 per decade, and we can talk about that. A lot of that is due to the reduction in what are called sulfates, which are cooling molecules which are put up as a byproduct of fossil fuel emissions. And there's been attempts around the world, particularly with shipping and in China, to reduce the amount of sulfates, and the dropping away that cooling mask has produced an increase of warming. So at 1.5 now, the rate has accelerated, and we will continue with this faster rate for the next two or three decades.
It is such a tragic state of affairs that our attempts to finally clean up pollution and move to renewable energy is unmasking more heat. Thank you for that point.
Well, I guess that's what Jim Hansen called the Faustian bargain, the bargain with the devil. I mean, we've produced all these fossil fuels. We've produced a lot of aerosols along the way, particularly from dirty fuels. I mean, sulfur-rich fuels. And they, of course, are the basis of acid rain, which is a terrible thing because it kills a lot of people each year. So people want to clean it up. But when you reduce that temporary cooling mask, the reality of what we've done comes to the front of the stage.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
So risk maps keep calling events 1 in 500 years. Then they repeat within a couple of years. What's broken in how we assess extremes?
We have had devastating floods in Australia over and over again, the northern part of New South Wales where I came from, and they keep on saying, oh, this is a 1 in 100 or 1 in 500 year event, and then they happen 2 years in four. And I mean, that tells us one simple thing, that the estimates of the risks are underdone. They're using old risk data. They're not using data which concurs with the changing reality, because in a fast warming climate, the past is no longer a guide to the future. And this is the danger that we have, that the rate of warming is increasing. We have another set of problems, which many scientists talk about, in that aspects of the system are not linear. We know, for example, more CO2 will produce more warming. I mean, some of these basic relationships are one that well understood. More CO2, more warming means that the atmosphere will hold more moisture, so you get heavier rain. But there are other things, the really large systems, which are not linear and predictable. I mean, an ice sheet out on Antarctica or in Greenland has a certain inertia, and it is solid, and it will stay there through a range of temperature. Then it gets to a tipping point, this boundary, when it then moves to a different state. And this non-linearity is very difficult to model. You can't put numbers on it. I mean, I think people have been shocked by the recent material that's come out, for example, on the Atlantic Meridian overturning system. I mean, some people call it the Gulf Stream. It's that system that takes huge amounts of moisture from the Caribbean right up the north coast of the sorry the east coast of the US and into northwestern Europe. And I mean, the world's best researcher, Stefan Rahmstorf, has come out with some new research, and the orthodox climate model saying that they have found a tipping point where the shutdown becomes inevitable, and it's probably in the next 10 to 20 years. I mean, this was something that 20 years ago nobody thought would happen for 1,000 years. And if the AMOC collapses, which, according to their models, might take 100 years, that would make agriculture non-viable in the UK, in Ireland, in northwestern Europe. It would profoundly change the world and its politics. And that's a non-linear, slightly unexpected event. And these are the things that risk analysis has trouble coming to grips with, because they're not easily projected and you can't put numbers on them. So that's why we have always said, when you're looking at climate risks, try and understand the plausible worst case scenario, the top end, the worst thing that could happen, because that is where the damage is the greatest, and that's what you need to understand. I mean, there's no point getting in a lift and saying, oh, there's 999 chances out of 1,000 that it won't jam. It's the 1,000th that you need to understand. The same with a bridge, the same with an aeroplane. It's the worst case scenarios that you need to engineer against.
Yes, definitely agree. Thank you very much.
David, if you had to update one public metric or dashboard next week, what would it be and why?
That's a big question. I would say the trajectory of future warming, because it's ironic that we have the evidence that we have 1.5 now, and that it is accelerating. This is not the fringe of science, this is the core of science now. And yet you have people saying, oh, when we get to 1.5,
As though we're
oh,
not
and
there.
I mean, our government is about to announce new emissions targets for the future, and they're saying, what carbon budget do we have left for 1.5? I mean, this is dumb. I mean, the fact is, and it's a harsh reality, is that we have 1.5 now. We also know that what's called the Earth's energy imbalance, which is the difference between incoming and outgoing radiation, has doubled in the last 20 years. And Earth's energy imbalance gives us a bit of a picture of future warming. It shows you how much more is in the system. And there's probably another degree there. So I think the understanding of future warming is really underdone in certainly amongst NGOs and activists, who often seem to be focused on the IPCC and its reports, which are out of date. I've written a lot about this, how they're reticent. And so I think people are coming to grips with the nature of current and future warming is the basis of talking about what needs to be done and why interventions are necessary.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense.
Unfortunately.
Yes, unfortunately, I wish you were not correct.
Okay, so I'm going to move into some policy questions. What are policymakers still getting wrong about near-term timelines, and what's the most urgent course correction this year?
Well, I think we keep on having this somewhat delusional debate about carbon budgets, which they said, oh, how much more carbon can we put into the atmosphere before things get bad? It's sort of like arguing, how close can I get to a black hole till I fall in,
Yeah.
which is not the best way to walk along a cliff, if you know what I
No.
mean.
Yeah.
And so, I think the fundamental point is that climate change is already dangerous. And this
Right.
is the thing that a lot of people, at 1.5 degrees right now, we have passed a number of significant tipping points. In Australia, we have the Great Barrier Reef. And the evidence is clear, and it's been there for 10, 15 years, that if you hold temperatures at 1.5, it is in a death spiral and it will be gone. We know from recent science, in fact, Eric Rigneau said this 10, 11 years ago, that less than 1 degree was the tipping point for West Antarctica. I think people like Jason Box are saying the same thing about Greenland. So it's not the fact that this evidence is in the future. These tipping points are now and we are passing them. So the idea that we have a carbon budget to make things worse is madness. It's delusionary.
Right.
So I think the starting point is to say climate change is already dangerous. The CO2 level is too high. And when people say to me, well, how much carbon budget do we have left? When should we be at zero? I smile at them and say, well, yesterday. And it's
Exactly.
not, and it's not, it's, it, I'm not just being silly. I mean, it's actually true. So I think that's the policy foundation from which we move forward, because we have to understand that if we were to stay at 1.5, which we're not, because it's now clear that the trajectory stays towards 3 degrees, which is like, social collapse, another whole story. If we were to stay at 1.5, the consequences are in the longer term that that would produce a sea level rise of tens of meters. I mean, our past climate history tells us this. I mean, during the last ice age, which was about 4 or 5 degrees cooler than now, sea levels were 60, 80 meters lower than now. So we know that there's 10 to 20 meters of sea level rise per degree in the long term. So I think if we can say this is already too hot, it's already dangerous, we don't have any carbon budget, if we want to sustain human civilization and society, our coastal living, the sort of river deltas, the great river deltas of the world on which we grow more food than anywhere else, the Ganges and the Nile and the Mekong and so on, then we have got to get down below 1.5. And Jim Hansen said half a degree, not half a degree of warming, because that was about the top of the Holocene, the top of that stable period that we have. And we have got Australian scientists saying in the long run it will be desirable to get back where we were in terms of carbon dioxide 200 years ago. So to me, that's the scientifically based picture of where policy needs to go.
Right. Thank you. That was a great answer. Thank you.
David, renewables often add capacity without displacing fossil fuel use. What policies force true substitution instead of expansion?
Well, I mean, the problem at the moment is that energy demand, and we are seeing this in India and China, we're seeing it now with AI and servers and so on, which have a huge increase need for electricity. It means that that increased demand is soaking up renewables, and renewables are not cutting into the existing energy base. So if you wanted to drive down fossil fuel energy much more quickly, the best thing you could do would be to reduce the demand for electricity. I mean, for example, if you can replace, this is very optimistic, 3% of the world's fossil fuel generating capacity with renewables each year, if you can replace 3% and energy demand is growing at 3%, then you get near zero change. If you had a recession and the economy crashed by 3%, then you would replace 6% of that in a year. So growth in energy demand, growth in the economy is undermining the capacity for new renewables to take over. That's the sad reality. So really strict control on energy demand is a key. And I mean, for example, I mean, just about the fastest growing sector of demand is international travel, which is luxury travel. It's not basic consumption. Most of it's not necessary. It's a delusion that we can tick so many boxes that when we die we'll go to heaven because we've been to every country on earth. This is mad. It's not necessary. You can have a nice holiday 50 kilometers from where you live, climb a mountain, go to the beach, sit on an island, and that conspicuous consumption is being driven by 10% or less of the world's population. If in the same world we would say no more conspicuous, unnecessary international travel. And that would knock 10% off emissions. You decarbonize by 10%. So those are the sort of things that I think we need to do. And people say, oh, that's a bit drastic. You know, the market runs, it's a growth area. Well, so is digging a hole and filling it in, so is making nuclear weapons, so is funding a war. I mean, because it creates job and pollution doesn't mean it's a good thing. And it just goes to the nature of the challenge we have, which that governments have to lead. And that leaving it to the market and our inexhaustible capacity to consume things that we don't need is not a solution.
That's a very good point. Thank you.
Name a policy that sounds good on paper but disappoints in practice, and how would you redesign
Oh, how long have we got?
it?
I mean, offsets. Carbon offsets. I mean, the basis of market-based carbon reductions is, yes, we will set a price for carbon and you will pay a tax if you don't reduce your emissions. But hey, rather than reduce your emissions, you can give money to buy them from somebody else who's reduced their emissions. So this idea of carbon trading. So we have a scheme on the edge of Australia where it rains sometimes and doesn't other that we're going to put in a whole lot of almond trees or something, and they're going to draw all this carbon, and we're going to sell the credits for these almond trees the day they're planted. And then there's a drought and they all die and the offset disappears. So I mean, there's a clear literature that carbon offsets, carbon trading has become a scam. And it's actually not driving down emissions. So that's emission reductions have got to be real. And if, and this comes, to the heart of the interventions debate, if you can restore some forest or a degraded wetland and introduce the amount of carbon drawdown, that should be being used to draw down the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. It shouldn't be used to give a free pass to somebody else who wants to admit more.
Great, thank you. Okay, so we'll just pivot and talk about risk. So, for a non-specialist, what do overshoot and hysteresis really mean, and why might quote unquote cool later not undo certain losses?
So in 2015, at the Paris Agreement, they said we're going to aim for this 1.5 to 2 degree temperature range, but because we're actually not going to reduce emissions, we're going to have this thing called overshoot, where, for example, we'll go past 1.5 or 2 to 2.5 degrees. And then later in the century, various mechanisms, drawdown, less emissions, will get the temperature back down. So you go over the target and then you come back down. So here's the question. If we're at 1.5 now and we're going to have overshoot to 2.5 degrees, which is certainly where we're going, and there's an ecosystem like a coral reef or a wet tropic forest or the Amazon that will actually die, or a whole lot of species that will become extinct at 2 degrees, what happens? You get to 2.5, all these things cease to exist, and you come back down and you go, oh, it wasn't like this is not like where we were when we had at 1.5 50 years ago. All these things have disappeared, and this is what's called, I mean, in physics or systems theory, hysteresis, where a path from A to B is not the same as a path back from B to A. I mean, and it happens in species. It also happens with large ice sheets, because history shows us that a large ice sheet can melt much more quickly. Then it can be rebuilt. And for example, cryosphere scientists have said the tipping point for West Antarctica might be about 1 degree, but if you actually wanted the ice to reform, you'd probably have to get back to zero. So this idea of overshoot and coming back is, like the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages selling indulgences.
David, what's a plausible worst case we should actively plan against? And how do we plan without paralyzing people?
Okay, two questions there. Where are we going? I think the majority of scientists think we're going to about 3 degrees or more at the moment. I mean, certainly
Wow.
the fact that the fossil fuel industry and petrostates are on the offensive at the moment. There's been a real change since COVID and the Ukraine war because they can see they can make a lot of money at the moment. So you see the fossil fuel industry, but also central banks and so on, pulling back on commitments. There's a
Yes.
quite conscious move in the opposite direction. And so even the United Nations Environment Programme reports on the emissions gap says, look, by 2050, from what we can see, it's not what we want, but what we see is emissions, might be down 10 or 20% from where they are now. And that's a path 3 degrees of warming, and 3 degrees of warming would create global chaos. I mean, I can just give you one example. There's some very good research done because we're in Australia, Asia is to the north of us. There's some research done on what they call the area of the world that would be unlivable, too hot. Practically speaking, in the hot season, in hot days, if you're not in an air conditioner, it's going to be too hot to survive. It's called beyond the human niche. And at 2.73 degrees, that's probably 1.5 billion people
Wow.
in Asia,
Yeah.
particularly South Asia. If we had pictures, I could show you the map. But it's the whole of India and Pakistan, and it sweeps across to Indonesia and bits of the Philippines and Malaysia and so on. I mean, yes, you can sit in your house with air conditioning, but most of those countries do not. 95% of the population do not have air conditioning. And it's probably too hot to sustain rice production because germination ceases past a certain critical point. So at 3 degrees, we are heading towards a world which we can only imagine because we've never seen it before, but it will be devastating. Your second question is the question, I guess, about hope and fear. How do we actually talk about these things? I would say that Sigmund Freud, the sort of godfather of psychoanalysis, talked about the talking cure. If you're going to come to grips with the neurosis or the things which are making your life miserable, the only way to do it is to talk it out. By repressing it, by not talking about it, it deepens. And I think that's true of all problems. And so when people say, oh, we want hope, not fear, our climate minister in Australia is always saying, David, people want hope, not fear. Their life is too difficult. And my response is, when it comes to big crisis, whether it's COVID or smoking or AIDS, which are public health issues, and in a sense, climate maybe is a public health issue too on a much larger scale. In those public health issues, we're actually really honest about the problem. We were really honest about AIDS. We were really honest about smoking. We were really honest about COVID and said, look, this is a mind-blowing threat. We've got to do some really serious things. There is a solution, and here's how you can get to the solution, an efficacious path. And all the studies show that that's what works. So I would say we should learn from public health education publication that being honest, brutally honest about the problem, understanding what the solutions path is very clear, even if it's a radical one, and finding the path from problem to solution is the key thing to do. I mean, it's what military people do in wars. There's no point pretending that your opponent isn't over the hill and they've got a nuclear bomb and everything's going to be all right and we'll just hope and we'll all live forever. I mean, that's mad.
I really like that public health example, and we could certainly learn from that. And we're talking about this now, so thank you for being here. Yes, we're on the way.
Talking is easy, doing is difficult.
Yes.
Yes.
I wanted to share just a quick personal story based jumping off what you were talking about, if we, heading towards 3 degrees. I live here in New York City, and during the summer, the heat wave, we had several heat waves, and they were so bad. And I thankfully have an air conditioning unit. However, the electricity company had sent out so many warnings telling us to limit the energy usage, turn off your ACs, and all this other stuff because, the infrastructure couldn't even handle it. And there's a lot of neighborhoods, their powers went out, and they, had to stay in their apartment without any AC. And I remember, like, actually, my computer turned off while I had a power blip while I had the AC on. And I just remember sitting here thinking, like, this is insane because I've never dealt with something like this before. And it made me think about the future. And I was just like, how's our infrastructure going to even handle that? So that was just, a personal story that I experienced over the summer.
And look, I think there's a really important lesson in that because we often get, if for example, in IPCC reports, projections about future warming, and you'll get this business about, there's a 50-50 50-50 chance, a mid-range chance that warming will be in a certain point 2 degrees. Right? People go, okay, 2 degrees. But it's not the averages that kill people, it's the extremes. And the work that's been done by climate scientists recently, and people like Catherine Hayhoe and others are saying this, is we have not understood the extremes as well as we should. Extremes are being more extreme than we thought. And there are physical reasons for that, to do with the destabilization of the jet stream, and the blocking systems that led to an incredible event on the east coast of the US. The sort of heat in Europe, these heat domes, which is just staying stationary. So it's the extremes that we need to understand, not the averages.
Exactly. Okay, so we'll change the subject a little bit and we're going to get into cooling options. So you've suggested testing cooling interventions earlier rather than waiting for a deeper crisis. What criteria would you use to judge efficacy, ethics, and governance?
Okay, so the big question that we could spend hours on. Look, it's really clear that 1.5 is dangerous. We've already talked about how it will just destroy societies and systems and drown coasts and radically change how we do. So it's obvious that we have to stop emissions really quickly. We need to get the carbon dioxide levels down through drawdown in various methods. But that's not a quick answer. It's a necessary answer, but it's not quick. I mean, we are putting up 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide a year. I mean, I did a rough figure, and if you can draw it down for $100 a ton, and there are limits, if you were just to draw down what we put up each year, that's probably between 5 and 10% of the global economy. So this is maybe it's only 4 or 5%. But I mean, it's a really big thing and it's slow. I mean, we've got to cut down the existing emissions to zero, then we've got to draw it down. You're not going to snap your fingers and in 10 years, it's going to be there. It's probably a 100-year project. Even if we really said it was a war economy, really applied ourselves, it's a really big project. And during that time, we've got the overshoot problem that the system's going to go to levels of warming where the AMOC will be triggered and ice sheets will be and melting that can't stop. So we need to find some quick form of cooling. We really do. We really do. I mean, I think that's a foundation. And if you don't get that, and I know all sorts of climate NGOs and so on who are opposed to it, I just say to them, you're involved in climate triage. You're sitting there saying you're prepared to bargain away ecosystems, things that you wanted to conserve. And places we love, you're bargaining them away because you're not prepared to deal with the reality that we need to cool the planet. So that's where we are. I've really been impressed by the work of a great American scientist called Mike McCracken, who worked in government and is writing about this, who I think is really good because he says, we talk about cooling as something we can do in the future. It may not be perfect, we haven't got all the answers, but he says, if you wait too long, it actually won't work. He says, time is not on our side. If you delay the research too long, the interventions may not work as well in 30 or 40 years as they do now. And I think that's just a fundamental point. I think the second question is not a question of interventions may have adverse consequences and compare that to the status quo to now. Because the comparison you have to make is between the efficacy of interventions and 3 degrees. Without the interventions, we'll be at 3 degrees. So saying, oh, our interventions might be worse than now, that's apples and oranges. And I think that obviously interventions should be applied if you can demonstrate that they are of net social and environmental benefit. There will be downsides, there will be upsides. This is not a perfect world. But if you can demonstrate that you're better off with them than without them, so I think the research should continue. I think the application and testing of it should continue. And it's really interesting that in the United Kingdom, the government there has set up a research program with 50 million pounds, I think, 100 million Australian dollars, to look specifically at these intervention and testing questions, which I think is a really good step. The United States government has been funding this work one way or another for quite a long time. And I know there are people with bad intent, like fossil fuel companies, who want to fund it because of an excuse to keep on emitting. So we have to say cooling only works if it is combined with radical emission reductions. That is the bottom line. But it's actually what I've come down to is what is the least worst option? Get off our high horses and go, oh, this could have a problem, that could have a problem. I don't believe in that humans should intervene in nature. And you go, oh, I think we've been intervening pretty seriously for 100 years. The sort of hands-off old style 50-year-old conservation paradigm no longer works. We're way past that. And so it's a really simple question: what is the least worst option going forward? And that, I think, based on what the scientific reality is. In terms of the question of governance, I see there's a lot of NGOs spending a lot of time on governance, and well, some of them, I think, with good intent, some of them with bad intent. Some of them are there to try and stop things happening, others want to try and sort it out. That's all good. I would say that if things get bad enough, the governance debate will be pushed to one side. I don't know. I mean, people who read Kim Stanley Robinson, a great sci-fi writer, he wrote a book about called Ministry for the Future, about a scenario in India where it gets so hot that people start dying everywhere, literally. And the Indian government says, we're going to do something about this. We're going to do some climate interventions because we have to protect our people. So I think governance will work till it won't. And if things, it should be sorted out, but not sorting it out will not practically stop things being done. And in China, there are tens of thousands of people employed in activities of this nature. I mean, they have a long-term program and action to try and move moisture from the Tibetan Plateau to the north of China, which is desertifying. And it's not a theory, they are actually trying to do it by various practical means. So the idea that this is some future event misunderstands where we are right now.
I did read that book, Ministry of the Future, and it was very that first chapter was very scary and powerful. So, yes.
Well, I think it makes a practical political point that's
It sure
important
does.
in this discussion.
It does. Yes. So just to pull it maybe a little more local. If a city gave you $100,000 Australian dollars tomorrow, what's the first heat risk action that you would fund, and what would you not fund?
I think the first thing is to make sure that the political elite and the population in that area understand the problem precisely as it is. You need public support to do what are not normal, conventional business as usual things.
Yes.
That's the big picture. What's the local picture? Here's the contradiction. It's sort of I call it the adaptation trap or dilemma, that in a warming world, if you put all your money into adaptation, that is, for example, we know in heat waves, it is the most vulnerable parts of the populations that are most severely affected. So in our city, for example, local councils, local government have a whole lot of processes of making town halls and swimming pools and gyms available, which is great. I mean, that's all necessary. But if you spent all your money on adaptation, in a climate world and none on mitigation, in the end, everybody would die because it'd get too hot. So this, I mean, there's this terrible sort of moral dilemma. Maybe they teach it in philosophy 101 now, between adaptation to try and protect people now and the structural need for a cooler climate. And I think that's a challenge everywhere, including in a local area.
No, that's a very good point. That is a tough balance.
So you've got to do things to protect people, but you've got to have the structures and the political support and the education and the public acknowledgement that big, crazy, big, difficult things are going to have to be done if we're going to have a world which is livable in 50 or 100 years.
Good point. To take it even one step more narrow, we like to put in the podcast a try this section where we provide listeners with a concrete takeaway from today's discussion. So, David, what's one actionable tip listeners can use this week at home, at work, or in their city?
One,
Or two.
understand the problem as it really is. This discussion, the sort of things we're talking about, are discussions that we never have at a political level in our country. We never hear leaders, we never hear major political parties anywhere in the world. The UN Secretary General gets it. He's great. He
He
talks about the
is.
climate emergency and he really gets it, and the UNEP people get it, but at a political level, we are ignorant. So that's a sort of a big thing. I mean, the problems are systemic and social and wide. So I'm not an advocate of saying we all go bush and live in a hut and grow a whole lot of veggies and drop out. That's going to solve the problem. It might solve the problem for us. It won't solve the problem for the world. But I would say that the most conspicuous, unnecessary forms of consumption which we all have in our lives are the things that we should think about. I mean, I think air travel is a big one. 10% of world's emissions. We can decide not to fly anymore. We'll have a perfectly reasonable life. It'll be fine. Be fine. My grandmother lived to 105. Scottish origins, tough as can be. At home till almost the day she died. And the town and the quite large river valley she lived in, she only left twice in her life. You know, she had a locality, an area in which she lived. You know, it was 10 miles to the beach and another 10 miles up to the mountains, and the valley was probably 20 miles wide. But that was her life. I mean, this idea that we have to roam and conquer the planet, and tick boxes and sit on, you know, foul cruise liners and you know, experience airports and aeroplanes, which is just about the worst environmental experience anybody have, and think it's a joy and a benefit, is pretty crazy.
Definitely. So we're going to explore another segment called Myth versus Measurement. David, what's a climate myth you would retire today and the measurement that replaces it?
I think the myth that we have time,
Good point.
the idea that people will talk about zero 2050 or what will happen in 2100, or if we don't do anything, that in 1 or 2 decades this will happen. I mean, time has run out. I mean, a really interesting example, I mean, the whole zero by 2050 means as soon as you think 10 or 20 years ahead, you defer it. We make decisions for the short term, and politicians do because they're in for 2, 3, or 4 years. So long-term targets are just an excuse not to act. And for example, the whole thing about net zero 2050 was for 2 degrees with really bad assumptions. But let's assume that was the case. And the IPCC said we'll be at 1.5 around about 2040 in 2018. And now we're here now. So we have reached 1.5 15 years earlier than politicians and policymakers thought when they set net zero 2050. So that would mean logically that net zero 2050 should now be net zero 2035 because the timeline has been shortened by 15 years. I mean, this is logic 101, but nobody says that. So I think these are the sort of metrics, and this timeline are the sort of myths that need to be demolished.
Yes, I hear
Definitely.
so many people talking about things in the far future, generations from now, or 50 or 100 years. And it's like, no,
Oh,
sadly,
yes.
no.
I'm going to start losing weight or stop smoking or start exercising after Christmas.
Right. So let's pivot to a little more positive note. And could you kindly share one underreported practice, policy, or technology that gives you cautious optimism?
I think our history teaches us a lot. In the United States, for example, when the United States decided to enter World War II, the US president and his advisors dragged in the major car companies and said, "We have news for you. You have built the last civilian cars until the war is over." And they said, "Yes, sir, we agree." I mean, there was a radical political change that produced a radical immediate change on the ground. And I think what we see in various places around now, if governments lead, then the system will follow. And we see countries that really are often not the rich countries, not the the countries with high standards of living, doing the transition now. So I think the really good lesson is if there is political will, the path is there. It is essentially, in large measure, not an economic or a technical insurmountable obstacle. It's a lack of will, and that's a really good thing I take out of what's going on. We have the solutions. I mean, solar panels are somewhere between a hundredth and a thousandth of the cost they were 30 years ago. Even in the last 10 years, battery storage has transformed the system, and the whole idea of baseload power is now out. I mean, I was
Yes.
just reading a story yesterday in Australia that even wind is in some trouble because it turns out that solar, and in this country, we have a really high uptake of solar panels on roofs
That's great.
through some government support and a very sunny country, and power prices were so high that everybody worked out it was cheaper to put panels on your roof and more recently put on a battery than to keep on paying a utility. So, I mean, you see that sort of transformation. They're saying it's these technological changes are really rapid and disruptive, and coal is dead for energy. I don't think it's the problem anymore. I mean, it's the problem with metallurgical coal. I mean, the big issue now, in a way, is gas.
Right,
Because gas, when exported, is as polluting as coal. The fugitive emissions from methane and so on are happening. So my really positive thing is, if there is political will, we have the technological and economic capacity.
Thank you. That's
Thank
a
you.
lovely place to end, I think. And David, Ariana, and I want to express our gratitude to you for joining us today and for your years of clear-eyed analysis.
Thank you so much, and all the best with the podcast. I won't say going forward because I hate that term, but all the best with your podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you. To the listeners, you'll find links to David's research and talks in the show notes. Please read, share, and put it to work. David, thank you again very much.
My pleasure.
Listeners, if this helped you understand the climate situation a little better, please follow the MIRR podcast, leave a review, and share it with someone who will benefit. Find notes and resources at MIRR.org and updates on X at MIRRSRM.
MIRR is a listener-supported. Your donations power public education and our ground-based democratic installations. Contribute at MIRR.org/donate.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more voices from the climate science and communication community.
See you next time.